Jessica Mitford.
Perfect, yeah. Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here. An unexpected, huge honor for me to be introducing the main speaker today. To me, the delights of Gore Vidal's new collection of essays, United States, 1952 to 1992, are many and varied, but for some reason, my eye first lit on an article about E. Nesbitt, which begins, quote, "After Lewis Carroll, E. Nesbitt is the best of the English fabulists who wrote about children, neither wrote for children, and like Carroll, she was able to create a world of magic and inverted logic that was entirely her own," unquote. Well, then he goes on to describe her marvelous stories, and I'm overcome with a flood of instant recognition. She was my all-time favorite as a child, to be reread throughout life, but fancy Gore Vidal knowing about them. I mean, those are virtually unknown in this country, whereas he points out how to do it books dominate the children's book market. Practical books with facts is what's wanted. I've long admired Mr. Vidal's work, his writings, and his politics, but his appreciation of E. Nesbitt was new to me, and now I hope will be a permanent bond between us. It so happened that as I was savoring the Vidal literary criticisms, I came across an ancient paperback of Cyril Connolly's essays. Connolly was the undisputed doyen of British critics, and I had a look through to see how these giants of the craft compared in their respective views of 20th century writers. Here's one example. Here's Cyril Connolly on Henry Miller, Tropic of Cancer. He wrote, "Anyone interested in the problem of American genius, whether it can ripen or ever achieve real freedom and honesty in its home surroundings, should try to get this book, which would appear completely to justify expectation. Apart from the narrative power, the undulating swell of a style perfectly at ease with its creator, it has a maturity which is quite unlike the bravado, the spiritual ungrown-upness of most American fiction." And this is what Gore Vidal has to say on the same book and writer. Miller was that rarest of literary types, a true American proletarian who had somehow discovered literature, and then, in a wacky, autodidactic way, made himself a master of a kind. If he often sounded like the village idiot, that was because, like Whitman, he was the rest of the village as well. We had that. But what I was really looking for was the origin of the famous long-running feud between Vidal and Norman Mailer. That long-running battle of those literary heavyweights that has kept us entertained and enthralled for lo these many years. Here is a sample of Vidal on Mailer. His subject is Mailer's book, Advertisements for Myself, and his propensity for public confession. So Gore Vidal writes, "It may be possible to get away with this sort of thing today, for we live in the age of confession. What Mailer has done is no different in kind from what those deranged and fallen actresses have accomplished in ghost-written memoirs where, with a shrewd eye on the comeback trail, they pathetically confess their sins to Demos, receiving for their tears the absolution of a culture obscenely interested in gossip. I suspect Mailer may create more interest in himself by having made this, quote, clean breast of it, unquote, than he would have got by publishing a distinguished novel. The audience no longer consumes novels, but it does devour personalities. Yet what happens after one is eaten? Is one regurgitated? Or does the audience move on to its next dinner of scandal and tears, its previous meal absorbed and forgotten?" Now, I loved all that, but I don't know about you, but I've always enjoyed those slanging matches between literary giants in the New York Review of Books and the like. Gore Vidal and Norman Mailer are particularly interesting sparring partners. And what's more, they've been at it on television, or now perhaps many years ago. But around that time, a story was going the rounds, which may be apocryphal. If so, Mr. Vidal can set me straight. But here's the story. He sent Mailer an advanced copy of a new book of essays and criticism. Mailer was surprised to see that there was no inscription on the title page. Turning to the index, he found Mailer Norman, next to which Vidal had written, "Hi, Norm." For my instruction and great pleasure, Bob Baldock lent me a cassette of Gore Vidal's election campaign of 1982, when he was running for U.S. Senator from California against Jerry Brown, then the governor of this state. The cassette is almost entirely clips from Vidal's public appearances. We see wildly enthusiastic audiences of all sorts and conditions, students, welfare mothers, lines of unemployed, old age centers, and so on. To my sorrow, there is no debate between the candidates Vidal and Brown. Brown, it seemed, didn't want to play. In the one joint meeting, a dinner occasion, we are told that the format was dictated by Governor Brown, who sits looking very sour as Vidal expounds his program. But here's what I found so fascinating. This all happened 12 years ago, 1982, yet the Vidal message is as fresh as any daisy and so completely applicable to everything in today's headline news. On the healthcare horror scene, Vidal talks about excluding the insurance companies and having universal healthcare provided by the government. And as he points out, he points out that every industrialized nation, except for the United States and South Africa, guarantees health care coverage for its citizens as a matter of right, like public education. Now, this, of course, was long before the Clinton ill-conceived managed competition plan that leaves the insurance companies in full command. As Vidal foresaw in 1982, the single-payer plan for the government to insure all of us is once more attacked by the medical pharmaceutical insurance industry as socialized medicine. And here's another bit of Vidalian prescience. On video, he's talking about the latest crime bill, the one projected in 1982. His point is that the same old crime bill keeps coming back. He says it's like Dracula buried with a stake through its heart, but he always manages to get back up. And we can see that today, the same thing. Finally, on the same video, I learned that Nabokov had once told Gore Vidal that his name in Russian means one who has seen grief. Yet I'm pretty sure that Gore Vidal, one of our great humorists, will have us laughing through the tears. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Gore Vidal.
It actually wasn't me who wrote "Hi, Norm" in the index.
It was William F. Buckley, Jr.
I I was coming over here today, I was thinking about my first time I spoke out here. It was in 82 in that Democratic primary. And I thought, really, what an eclectic group. There were 9 candidates for the Democratic nomination for Senate. Governor Brown was number 1, and he won, only to lose to Pete Wilson in the November. Today, he is a radio talk show host in Oakland. I came in number 2, and I most recently have been co-starring with Joe Pesci in a Warner Brothers picture. And number 3 was State Senator Paul Carpenter, who is now on the lam. But the one thing you can say about the Democratic Party in California, not one of us was a lawyer. I have a speech for you. It runs about 25 minutes. I'm going to have to read it. I will look up from time to time in order to give an air of spontaneity. I love politicians with written speeches, particularly when they haven't written them themselves or indeed looked at them. Ronald Reagan was standing on one of his campaigns with holding a speech in front of the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and the wind came along, and speech blew away. He said, "Well, there goes foreign affairs." General Eisenhower always read his speeches with a sense of real discovery. In 1952, we were in one of our numerous wars in Korea, and so he was droning on, and he said, "And if elected president, I will go to Korea." He was elected. He went. So I'm going to give some reflections upon the State of the Union and answer questions, whatever we can do back and forth, once I have spontaneously gone through my written text. You know, I spend a lot of time writing a speech, and it's always the same one. People afterwards say, I heard you say that 3 years ago. If you find repetition, just remember that monotony is a sign of sincerity. Last week, I was traveling around Los Angeles with a television crew. The BBC is doing a sort of morbid retrospective of my Hollywood life over the years. And so we were visiting the scenes of my various crimes against what Italians call the 10th muse, and we call the movies. As I had written a number of pictures for MGM in the 1930s, I said, "Let's go over to the Thalberg building, where I had my office." Phone calls were made to the new owners, something called Sony Pictures Entertainment, an optimistic trade name if ever there was one. Not self-fulfilling, as it has so far proven, but no, we could not go onto the lot, we were told. Why not? Well, Sony is trying to emphasize its corporate image, and so no former employee of MGM could come onto the lot, even though 40 years had passed. When it was pointed out that much of Sony's product is being made by former MGM employees, they said, "Well, they can work here, but they can't talk about MGM because we are promoting only Sony." Anyway, we circle the studio lot a number of times in a van, cameras rolling, I chatting away. Then we parked on a side street opposite the studio. A Culver City policeman suddenly appeared. "You can't shoot here," he said. "This is private property." The director said, "But this is a public street." The cop said, "No, this is private property." I said that the street was clearly marked as the property of Culver City. He repeated that it was private property, and so we moved on. I tell this story not to bash a Japanese corporation, particularly one that has my fullest sympathy, because by the time Hollywood's accountants are through with them, they will be in full retreat toward the setting sun. I mention this story to show that in the United States, everything, in effect, is the property of great corporations who pay little or no tax to the federal government, much less to state and municipalities where they do business. The only surprising aspect of this story is that we were told to move on not by a security guard of Sony, but by the Culver City Police Department, openly working for a private corporation at the expense of its own public. The United States is unique among nations in that it was created by lawyers. Over the years, we have become more and more a government of, by, and for corporate lawyers, and they show no sign of vanishing from the earth. Currently, 70,000 lawyers are at work in Washington, D.C. as lobbyists, whose task it is to make sure that corporations pay little or no federal tax, while seeing to it that a majority of our money goes to certain corporations under the sacred rubric defense. There is very little place for non-lawyers in government. White House, Congress, and of course, judiciary, are filled with lawyers who create intricate laws that their sometime partners, the lobbyists, then work to undo, all quite legally. The people at large are kept firmly outside the legal loop, which is now beginning to resemble a hangman's noose. The brightest lawyers, of course, are lobbyists and outside the government. The not so bright but fairly nice looking lawyers are sent to Congress or even to the White House, where we have two for the salary of one. That's a bargain, I'd say. And they don't charge by the hour. This state of affairs is taken for granted by the media, which is owned by the same corporations that pay for the lawyers who govern us. Back of them, there is the 1% that owns most of the wealth of the country. Unfortunately, they are never seen on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Few citizens know their names. For the curious, I recommend $1 in taxes, as well as taking $797,000 in tax credits for the creation of new jobs while, what else, firing workers. This is the pattern all across the country. What we have, in effect, is a society where the taxes of the people at large support the few, the wealthy few. In other words, we have socialism for the rich and free enterprise for the poor. How do they get away with it? Well, in 1950, Harry Truman, in tandem with the ownership of the country, decided to militarize indefinitely the economy. The Russians were coming. Communism was everywhere, even in our kindergartens. Anyone caught reading the New York Times without moving his or her lips was immediately suspect. The media was employed to convince us that the Soviets had not only surpassed us in weapons, but in consumer goods as well. After a trip to Moscow in those days, I was denounced as a communist when I pointed out that a country that doesn't know how to make a screw-on bottle top for its vodka is hardly a commercial rival. They still haven't mastered it. I often think if I had to do a screw-on bottle top, how I'd go about it. I mean, it's a difficult thing, technically, when you think about it, at least for me and for the Russians. For almost half a century, while our best research and development went for weapons, other countries were investing in consumer goods, and so we fell behind. Then, spitefully, the Soviet Union dissolved itself. That was unforgivable. They left us with a vast war machine and no war. A sane society would by now have begun the conversion from weapons to consumer goods. But our lawyers do not think long term. After all, they bill us by the hour. Most of the federal revenue still goes to what is known as defense. Hence the enemy of the month club. Gaddafi, Noriega, Saddam, Murphy Brown. As the great untouchable and untaxable corporations own the media, it is very easy for them to demonize, even just in a week or two, a nation, a people, an individual. Noriega was one of my favorites. He was an old employee of our corporate state, paid for by the CIA. But when he took seriously the treaty that we signed with Panama, giving them a bit more freedom than a colony of the free world ought to have, he became inconvenient, just like Gaddafi and Marcos and Trujillo and Castro and Allende and Lumumba and Arbenz and Mosaddegh before him. We got rid of or neutralized most of these leaders. Lately, we target only weak countries. We're not about to take on any more Koreas or Vietnams. That's too tough. Panama was a particularly glorious victory. Our air power was thrilling, particularly when we deployed at last that marvel of very expensive technology, the stealth bomber. It was a famous victory, so famous that our media forgot to report that Panama has no air force, and so is the perfect enemy. Then we kidnap Noriega, the leader of a foreign country, put him on trial in Miami in a court that has no jurisdiction over him. Now he's being held illegally in a federal prison for having been, somehow or other, the leading unproven drug dispenser and playground pusher in the United States. Everything that we have done in regard to Panama and Noriega has been illegal at every level. But that is a small price to pay for freedom and democracy, isn't it? Oh, what Reagan could do with that. The Gulf War, conducted by Bush of Mesopotamia. In tandem with CNN, was created in the boardrooms of interested corporations. No one will ever know, as no one is interested in, what actually happened there, or just how many of Saddam's people were killed. I never cease to marvel at how few Americans ever catch on to the now predictable process of demonizing. Because the scenario never varies. It was first printed up at Langley, Virginia, and it now just keeps on and on. First, the enemy is smeared as a sexual degenerate. Gaddafi's alleged eyeliner was a source of revulsion by heavily made-up anchor persons. The evil one not only molests Boy Scouts, but he also has voluptuous mistresses and naturally a long-suffering wife. Noriega, this was a new touch in the old Langley scenario, they found that he wore red silk knickers. Evil incarnate. Naturally, the enemy takes drugs as well as sells them. A mass of cocaine found in Noriega's bunker turned out to be tortilla paste. Finally, a portrait of Adolf Hitler inevitably hangs on the tyrant's wall, and a well-worn copy of Mein Kampf at bedside. Thus it is with all great enemies of our corporations and their employees in Congress, White House, and Pentagon, as they search for enemies in order not to demilitarize our economy. As effective as our enemy of the month club has been until now, it is not enough, finally, to justify all that money we still spend for procurement. So the militarized state that will not dissolve itself is now beginning to focus on a new enemy, an enemy that is already half subdued, but still capable of guerrilla warfare. I refer to the American people, to the 99% without representation in government or much access to expensive law. The rhetoric of the government gives the game away. Drugs are a bad thing. Therefore, we will declare war on drugs. That word, war. Most civilized countries believe that drugs are a medical, not a military problem. But it is only through war that our rulers feel that they can control the people. The first strike in any such war is the creation of prohibitions. Those who disobey arbitrary prohibitions can be sent to jail or otherwise intimidated. Sexual taboos have always been exploited in order to terrorize the population. Same sexualists are perennially vulnerable. Clinton's retreat on the integration of gays in the military was in response to a backlash from our rulers, and they put him firmly in his humble place. After all, he is just a backwoods lawyer fronting for the ownership, and if he gets above his station, he will be taken care of one way or the other. He, too, must obey the creators of the wartime economy and his more and more autonomous military leadership. Prohibitions on sex will be maintained until the end, not because anyone really cares about anyone else's sex life, but because a prohibition of any kind, whether it be same-sex or smoking marijuana, gives the government a convenient weapon to strike at those who, let us say, might criticize its wars. The war on drugs has proved to be the most naked example of a government intent on bringing all the people to heel. We are asked to believe that a government that has never cared about the health or welfare of 99% of the population is now deeply concerned that they might stupidly injure their health through taking drugs. Well, Virginia, your government does love you. And if you're caught smoking the evil weed or possessing a gram of coke, a vacation in one of our numerous prisons will bring you, if not good health, at least to your knees. You will learn that every citizen must obey the government and never, ever question who gets all that tax money. The current war on the American people, under the rubric crime, is doing almost as well as the famous war on communism used to do. Our prison population is now 1.2 million people. Out of every 100,000 Americans, 455 are in prison. South Africa runs us a poor second with 311. In addition, 3 million Americans are on probation or parole. Thanks to a number of race and class wars and easy access to guns, there is a good deal of violence in the United States. But it is not the violent or the dangerous to society who fill up the prison system. 60% of federal inmates have been convicted of drug offenses, often very minor. 22% of those in state prisons are drug offenders. This is control of the citizenry with a vengeance, particularly the black underclass. Anyone who understands the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence finds it impossible to regard as legitimate a government that feels free to pass laws forbidding its citizens to take drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, or any number of other products that might be bad for an individual's health, but are of no concern to any state except a totalitarian one, which we are now in the process of setting, as it were, in concrete with bars. A couple of weeks ago, an attorney general of a Midwestern state said that if all the prisons are built in his state, that the voters have been frightened into accepting, and if the sentences for possession of such minor drugs as marijuana keep going up, he predicts that in 30 years, half the population of his state will be in prison, and the other will also be in prison looking after them as jailers. I don't think that our founders would be well pleased with what we have become, and worse, are becoming. The Bill of Rights is under constant and usually successful assault. Half of the Fifth Amendment has now been discarded by the Supreme Court. Boyd versus United States was a famous case at the end of the 19th century. Boyd versus U.S. affirmed that not only did one have the right not to make an oral statement of a self-incriminating nature, but that one's private papers and records were equally privileged. Nonsense, says our present Supreme Court. Government prosecutors have every right to anyone's private records, including poor Senator Packwood's vivacious diary. I cannot see how, between the war against the liberties of the American people and simultaneously the bogus war on drugs and crime, that we will ever be able to control drugs by legalizing them, something that most civilized countries in one way or another have done or are doing. Heroin addicts in England do not need guns in order to rob money to sustain their habit. They are given a doctor's prescription, and that's that. But a prohibition on anything gives the state absolute authority over the people, and no state with such a power will ever let it go. Public opinion has usually acted as a brake on tyrants. But if public opinion, the media, is entirely controlled by the tyrants, then the people will never have the knowledge that they need in order to free themselves of a state gone bad. But we must never underestimate the ingenuity of the state. Take political correctness. Many people regard political correctness as just another joke. Others see it as the left forcing others to bow down to minorities, or as the right pretending to celebrate free speech in order to bash minorities. But no one seems to get the point to why this mysterious, divisive nonsense has taken off, particularly in the school system where the future consumers are trained. Machiavelli advised his prince, divide your enemies if you wish to prevail. If you wish to control all Americans, you must first divide them and then divert them from their true interests. And what better way to divide them than sex against sex, race against race, religion against religion? Not even that virtuoso of the lie, Joseph Goebbels, ever came up with anything so clever as political correctness. Meanwhile, as this group and that group are busy bashing each other, the rule of the 1% is secure and unquestioned. Ever since Jimmy Carter, successful politicians have got to the White House by pretending to be outsiders. Yet once arrived, they forget the rage of the people who sent them there. This strikes me as more stupid than cynical. Half the electorate so dislikes our political system that it does not vote at all. The other half doesn't like the system either, but their antennae are alert for anyone who speaks against whatever is this year's code for the rulers. The last election, it was gridlock. And Perot went even further than the two candidates of our single party with its two right wings. He actually talked about the budget and waste. But as he himself is very much an insider, a lobbyist, a Pentagon man, he could offer nothing very dramatic in the way of a solution. Also, it is no great secret, there's nothing much that any president can do to affect the economy other than to start a war. That is why we've had 30 or 40 undeclared wars since 1941. But after the first dozen or so, it became clear that although 1% does very well out of the wars, nothing much is trickling down to the people at large. Now we're told in the present budget debate that far too much is being invested in the people. Entitlements. Gosh, that Sunday zoo on television. Those faces get scarlet at the thought of entitlements. Wasting money on surgical stockings. So we're investing far, far too much in people and too little to retire the $4 trillion of debt that we accumulated while pursuing our various wars. It was not providing medical services for the elderly. Is that an earthquake? One never knows who is in the pay of the government. Actually, the U.S. spends less on the public sector than any industrialized nation. Here's an interesting statistic. American spending on welfare, this is federal, state, and municipal, from 1789 to the present day is less than the cost of the ongoing savings and loan bailout. Never let it be said that the ownership of the country has ever set out to weaken the moral fiber of the majority. It would be nice if there were a simple way out of our mess. Elect so-and-so and all will be well. But what is wrong is not cyclic, but systemic. Individuals, short of a dictator, don't make much difference in our system. Should there be any kind of revolt against our intrusive, prohibitive state, a dictator could be a possibility. A healthy society, less divided than ours, might reorder itself. Jefferson thought that the Constitution should be revised once a generation. I do too, even though the 1% will no doubt control a constitutional convention. And the result might be even more prohibitions, weapons, police, spies, including the monitoring of the entire population, something undreamed of in the 18th century. I think that those who would like to regain our liberties and the best parts of our lost republic must begin to use the weapons of the state in order to keep surveillance over the rulers. There should be more and more quickly transmitted information about the crimes of government. Also, the laws that are used to control the people can be either reversed or used for familiarizing society. In the name of accountability, the law can still be used to deter, let us say, an executive who by personal decree has committed us to an unconstitutional war. Ideally, we must cut the Pentagon budget, force corporations to pay taxes, just as individuals do, convert from weapons to consumer goods, retrain the workforce with the money thus raised. If that should prove to be not enough, then I propose that we tax the real estate and the portfolios of all of our extraordinary religious institutions. I search for a word, for a weapon in this struggle, and the best I can come up with is knowledge. Knowledge is power. It is no accident that the noun intellectual has been, if not demonized, trivialized in our society. Citizens who think are dangerous in the extreme to our unaccountable rulers. 30 years ago, C. Wright Mills wrote, "Fresh perception now involves the capacity to continually unmask and to smash the stereotypes of vision and intellect with which modern communications swamp us. These worlds of mass art and mass thought are increasingly geared to the demands of politics. That is why it is in politics that intellectual solidarity and effort must be centered. If the thinker does not relate himself to the value of truth in political struggle, he cannot responsibly cope with the whole of live experience." I suppose that is my message today. The unexamined life really is not worth living. So learn, think, communicate, act.
Some of the listeners from KPFA had already sent in some questions. And while we are asking these questions, if any of you have written down any others on the cards you were given, there will be people who will come around and get them from you. Mr. Vidal has not seen any of these. Only in Berkeley. And actually, he's covered almost all of them, which is the worst part. But here's one he didn't. Is a godless international socialism really the most we can hope for?
Well, it's not that bad. Certainly theocratic capitalist oligarchy is not a joy. I'm all for mixed pluralist societies. One nice thing about the American psyche, from the very beginning, we've always been highly resistant to ideology of any kind. This is the only country where communism never really had much effect because we'd already been inoculated by William Jennings Bryan and the funny money people along the way. We are sort of anti-ideology. The problem seems to me now is that we're resistant to ideas as well. We should be more open.
Now, this is a tough one. Based on your careful study of human history, how might the rise of fundamentalism in the world play out?
Well, fundamentalism is a sign of a breakdown in the economy of a state. It's wherever there's great poverty and you cannot look to the rulers for money, for succor, for anything, you will get God in one form or another. I have always thought that a great disaster that befell the West was monotheism. We were doing very well before then. In the Greco-Roman world and older civilizations, we're about to see, you young ones here will see it, I shan't, but I see the beginnings of it, the rise of China. Well, there you have a society that's 3,000 years older than we are. It's Confucian, and Confucius is an atheistic system of thought and of education. Rather better, I would have thought, for a people as mixed as Americans than these demented churches that we have. But our churches would have been a lot less demented if we had not exempted them from taxation. I knew a science fiction writer years ago when I was first starting out as a writer, most unattractive person I think I've ever met. And that is the god, L. Ron Hubbard. And you can't tax them. These Justice Department just found that they were a genuine religion. So we have yet another force in our lives which could be undone by taxation. But the rise of fundamentalism in the world, I think, has to do with really entropy. We're running out of everything. The next millennium will really be a struggle for water. It'll be who has control over the two ice caps and is getting water down, and there are going to be terrible wars over water. Now, that's a serious subject, unlike monotheism.
Now, here's a very good one. With April 15th approaching, would you condone non-payment of income taxes as a legitimate form of dissent? If so, how?
Well, we tried that at the time of the Vietnam War. I was co-chairman of something called the People's Party with Dr. Spock, and they will put you in jail. I think that if it were done on a sufficiently large scale, you could probably bring the government to its knees, but that takes organization. There's something, what is optimistic in what is rather a dark horizon, has been the rise of computers, cassettes, instant communication is now possible. So you could really organize a million people in a day or two, whereas before you had to mail letters, you'd have to wait, you'd have to do this, do that. There are a lot of things that can really happen suddenly. If you say to the government, if you don't cut 30% out of what you're now spending on military procurement, we won't pay 30% of our tax, they can't put 10 million people in jail. They will try. Have you heard the latest that the army camps, now that they are dumping the military personnel back into the civilian population, the generals knowing that the politicians will be blamed for this, they're now talking about using the military camps for drug offenders. So tax offenders might end up there as well. But I think it is a good ploy, but it has to be done on a large scale. I not only pay American taxes, I think I paid for the stealth bomber that year.38%, thank you.
Here on the campus, there's a lot of questions on this issue. So you did touch on it. Perhaps you could speak a little bit more. And it begins with, "Dear Sir Vidal, Happy Valentine's Day. What a treat you are. Question." It must mean this is the question, not what a treat you are.
Don't editorialize.
What is your thought on keeping standards low in the academic world in order to be politically correct, in order to pass along most students? These will be tomorrow's leaders.
Well, I'm not an academic, so I don't really know much about that. It has a slight right-wing bias, I should say, this question, which I point out diffidently. I don't think that any, let us say, medical department will suddenly, in the interest of the liberation of Lithuanian grandmothers, pass them through surgery courses. Equal opportunity is something else, again, which everybody should have in a civilized country, to have an education to the extent of his or her capabilities. That seems to be the minimum a state can do and must do. The other is politically correct stuff.
Ah, this one. How do you stand on death? Actually, the question is the right to die. The right to die, final exit. Please comment on your approach to issues being now raised by Dr. Kevorkian.
I should let you answer that, as you have written The American Way of Death. As I think every citizen has the right... What is wrong with this thing? Is this clearer? Good. As I think that every citizen has the right to lead his own life as long as he does not harm others in the process, every citizen has the right to end his life when and how he chooses. I think that is an absolute, and what the good doctor is up to, I haven't followed it that carefully, but if it's death by invitation, why not? I love this thing. They want us to live forever, but not feed us or educate us. I mean, it...
The next question is, will you ever forgive your dear friend, William Buckley? Please do, for he knows no better, at least for Valentine's Day.
I keep forgetting about Buckley, and then somebody keeps reminding me of him. Of course, I have a compassionate nature, and will forgive him everything. Naturally, I envy his literary career. Those CIA mystery novels, my God, you know. Whenever Norman Mailer and I are together, we say Buckley stole a march on us. I'll forgive him, but only on Valentine's Day.
My employer, who disapproves of this event, thinks that you are a traitor to your class. Is there a political caste in America?
When I was in the Senate primary, I was down in Orange County, and a woman got up and said, I have two questions, Mr. Vidal. The first is, what can I, as an average housewife, do to fight communism? And second, what is communism? Traitor to my class. You know, the first thing that you do if you set up shop as any sort of truth-telling writer or trying to tell the truth as you see it, is you get rid of your class. You declass yourself. So I can't think of any writer that I would say, well, that writer reflects a class. We can't always reorder our childhood, but we can certainly reorder our thoughts on almost everything. Is there such a thing as class in America? Of course there is. And the universities exist, particularly the heavily endowed one by the Eastern rich, to try and convince you that it isn't there. And I actually sat with two old friends who know everything, like me, Ken Galbraith and Arthur Schlesinger. You know Arthur, there is this pendulum, Schlesinger Jr. And they said, Gore, you've got to stop all this stuff about there being a class system. Right? No DuPont runs DuPont. John Levine from City College is president. Well, I said, yes, and when you go to Nelson Rockefeller's for lunch, as both you boys do, Nelson doesn't cook the lunch, does he? You hire managers. A ruling class, that's one nice thing about Bill Domhoff's books, is that he sat down and studied all the prep schools that everybody went to, what boards of directors, the bohemian thingamajig out there in the woods. And it gets smaller and smaller. These are just the people who work for the owners. And it's pretty tight. They run the foundations. They set up endowments. They decide the curriculum in a funny way, or at least they decide what's not going to be discussed. Yes, we have a class system, and it's doing awfully well, proof being that hardly anybody knows who's in it. That's ideal.
This one says, Mr. Vidal, your writings are accepted for publication in the United States, but those of Noam Chomsky are not. Does this mean that his views are even more outrageous than yours? Please comment.
Well, Chomsky and I often work side by side in the various political vineyards, and we are more alike than not alike. He's published pretty widely. I am also a novelist, which he's not, which gives me access to a world that he, as a polemicist or as a political philosopher, as well as linguist, may not have access to. I think what's more interesting is we did an hour together, he and I, with somebody asking us questions, right after the Gulf War, and we were critical of Bush of Mesopotamia and American military. It was a very interesting hour. No one would show it, Kalamazoo at Sunday morning TV. At 4 a.m, they would not show this. I think that tells you something about how a country is governed, you know, and how tight information, what a tight leash people are. I think Chomsky could be published by Random House tomorrow. And the way things are going, I might very well end up with the Evergreen Press or wherever he is.
Mr. Vidal, do you ever hear from Al Gore?
Well, they keep explaining to me how I'm related to him, and I keep forgetting. I don't know him. I knew his father, who was a very nice old populist who was very good on the Vietnam War. He was very much against it when it cost him a seat in the Senate, too. I went down for Gore Day in Mississippi. My mother's family are called Gore. And until young Al, I guess my grandfather, Senator Gore, was the Gore, but now he's been replaced. But there were 200 cousins that I'd never met. And they're from all over the South, and they run politics in that part of the world. It's quite extraordinary to see 200 variations of your own nose and the same elephantine ears. It was very humbling, actually. You realize that this is a gene pool that they say, okay, time, hand in those ears. We got to make another one. What I find just watching Albert on these talk shows is the one thing the Gores all seem to have in common is they're terribly funny. They're very sharp, Anglo-Irish, mean, but my grandmother, who was not a Gore, naturally, but she said, you know, they're brilliant, she said, but they got no sense. He's got too much sense about his career and not very brilliant about the country.
Question. What do you think of the state of feminism in the year 1993 as opposed to your observations of it in 1972?
I guess that was the piece that made Norman so angry at me. He wrote something called The Prisoner of Sex, and I wrote an all-out attack, not just on his book, but on Irving Howe and others who were enemies of the feminists, in, I thought, the most crude way. I would say since then, Norman and I are again friendly, and attacks on feminism are not as crude, at least not at that intellectual level, as they were 20 years ago, and it was quite unbelievable, the things that people got away with saying, which they wouldn't dare do about blacks or any other minority in the country, but they thought they could about uppity women. That has passed. I think the state of feminism now is like the state of humanism. I mean, everybody's in this same boat together. So, humanity, basically, I don't think has gender.
There are at least 15 questions in here asking if you will run for political office again. And if not, would you consider being king?
Let this cup pass unto others. I was just down in Washington for the same BBC retrospective on my life and times. And I went over to the Senate side, where I'd spent so much time as a child. My grandfather was blind, and I used to lead him on and off the floor of the Senate. And I ran into a couple of old friends, acquaintances, who are members of the Senate. And as I looked at them and talked to them, the paranoia in their eyes is now blazing. I mean, they are all mad as hatters, you know? And real paranoia, if you want to see absolutely startling paranoia, get to know a president. I mean, Jack Kennedy I saw quite a bit of on off-duty hours when he was president and before. I mean, the day starts with a blast to Tony Lewis in the New York Times, and his hands are trembling. Then all through the day, it's they. You see what they're doing?
Yeah, they are turning on me. They're making it impossible for this government to govern.
I have no desire to be that mad. And it's worth $1 million to me not to go to the Senate.
These two seem to be somewhat related, so I'll read them together. The first one is, although some progress has been made in society's acceptance of non-traditional sexuality, being oneself is still a challenge. Is there anything you have to say about to those who are struggling with their sexual identities? And the next one, which seems to be kind of on the same subject in a way, is Hillary Clinton a lesbian? Does this account for her husband's chubbiness?
Well, you know, only a country as schematic as the United States could ever
have tried to force the citizens into two arbitrary groupings, gay bad, straight good. That to me is perfect madness. Do you know that the word heterosexuality only came into English around 1930? And it first cropped up in, where else, the New York Times. So much for the only way of relating to others sexually. Homosexuality was invented in the 1890s. And it's a terrible neologism. The homo part is Greek, meaning same, and sexual is Latin, meaning sexual. So you have a Greek, half Greek, half Latin word to describe nothing. I mean, certainly not a person. It describes an act. But it never occurred to the Greeks or the Romans to have any words for these. People did what they felt like doing or could get away with. The idea that there was to be a division comes partly out of Christianity, comes from all directions. But it's largely for control. And it's a wonderful weapon now, as we still see going on. And it's been 46 years since I published a book called The City and the Pillar, which was about showing the normality of the act between two ordinary American boys. This caused great shock because I was in the Second War. I was writing about our generation. They were horrified, you know. It cost me the good opinion of the New York Times for many, many years. I think everybody is potentially everything, and I don't see that it makes any difference. I can't get very interested in whether Hillary has a girlfriend, a boyfriend. I do like some of the health plan, but that's about it.
There are also a load of questions about who do you think killed John F. Kennedy?
Well, it wasn't suicide. I think we start with the one fact that we all have. I assume that it was the mob. The Marcello gang in New Orleans seems to be the general consensus. It is interesting how little investigation was ever done. That strikes me as rather odd, but I think that was Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby was in charge of murdering Castro, Operation Mongoose, and he was terrified that if there was a deep investigation of Jack's death, they would probably find out about his own covert operations with the president's blessing to kill Castro. I don't think that he thought this would give the new frontier a bright burnish. And he was attorney general during the investigation, so he dragged his feet. And now, of course, it's the undead, that thing. Oliver Stone came to me with his script and about 2 or 3 years ago, and I said, this is awful. And he's not very bright, but he's got an enormous amount of energy. And this is a deadly combination in the arts. And I said, you know, I could help you with this a bit. Not only did I know Kennedy, but I knew Clay Shaw in New Orleans. But he didn't. He wanted Shaw to have been the head of a homosexual cartel that was out to kill Jack Kennedy because of his overt heterosexuality. That's the message of the movie that I got.
Next one. Paul Bowles, when asked to summarize his philosophy, said, "Everything gets worse. Do you agree? If not, why not?"
Well, Paul was simply reflecting, as he is now 82 years old and an old friend of mine. It's the second law of thermodynamics at work. Everything is running down. This applies to individuals as well as to political systems. maybe even the human race. When I was writing Creation, which takes place in the 5th century B.C., I cover the Buddha, Confucius, Socrates, and Zoroaster, and I suddenly got a chill in the middle of it, that here were four unrelated civilizations, in the case of China, no connection at all with the other three, and they were all going through the same crisis at the same time. There was one over writing. Everything had been oral tradition. You learn by heart the Iliad and the Odyssey. Then they began to write it down. Traditionalists said you've got to learn it. Modernists said you write it down. This went on in four separate societies. Interest rates were about the same in the four regions of the world. 22%, if you're interested. They were tight money people. Well, the chilling thought that came to me, and it's funny, it was the first thing Chomsky ever said to me when we met. He said how much he had liked that. He doesn't read novels, but he'd read that one. And he said, your thought that the human race is programmed is something that has often occurred to me, and in linguistics, of course, encodement is language from the Chomsky point of view. And then I said, well, then we have a problem, don't we? We know more or less when we were born as a human race. We've seen ourselves through reproduction, replication. We're getting slightly overcrowded. How old are we? I said, that's not for us to answer.
This one says it's an extraordinarily... Actually, it says it's an extremely, big question. Rush Limbaugh.